CliffCentral.com.
All right, we are live on a Monday morning, and Leanne has just gone off to the loo quickly, so she'll be another couple of minutes. But oh, there she is. Okay, she's finished. Well, that was a quick one.
Yeah, I didn't even flush.
Yeah, like the hip is really moving these days, Leanne.
you must have run there at like Oscar Pistorius speed. Well done.
Yeah.
All right. A few things that we need to talk about this morning that are definitely, these are things that are on everybody's minds. So first thing first, apparently, this is hilarious. So Checkers are being sued for 4,000 Rand. What is this all about? Because I was, the shop I went to on Friday was Checkers, and I didn't find a reason to sue them for 4,000 Rand. What stuff is this that's been going on?
So like in South Africa, right, because we have such an advanced banking system, you can send money through like ShopRite and Checkers, their money market thing, right?
So right,
this,
okay.
Yeah, so this lady,
I've never used that. I don't understand this.
So this person said, like, I think it's a lady, yeah. They sent it to Toy and Doy, but instead of being withdrawn from Toy and Doy, it was withdrawn somewhere in the Northwest. And then she's like, oh, she tries to negotiate with Checkers, basically gets up to headquarter levels, like, guys, I want my money back. Like, there were checks and balances. What are your checks and balances? Checkers is playing the, like, hide the ball game. And then, yeah, this lady just basically took them to court over 4 grand. She's like, I want my 4 grand, so I'm going to pay more.
Well, I think her legal fees probably would have come in at, like, 20 or 30 grand if she's lucky.
If she's lucky.
So. So, you know, again, they always, we tend to think, oh no, well, if I go to court, then I'll win and then I'll get my money back and all this stuff. The reality is, like, you probably lose money if you go to court in South Africa.
Yep, and this is a man who, you've been to court, Gareth.
once, and I'll never do it again. Like, I'll try to figure out, because the only people who score when you go to court are the lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. Right? But like 4 grand, like, is it the principle? Because it made me think, like, on principle, would you not sue though? Because this company is screwing you over.
Yeah, no, look, you've got to admire the balls that it takes to actually say, you know what, I'm taking you to court. I'm going to screw you because I'm not going to tolerate your shit.
Yeah, this
And I admire this woman. No, good for her.
This is not some legal don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer stuff. Like, she's going to court.
And joking atheist says quite rightly, when you're using Checkers as a banking system, you have to know 4,000 Rand is a lot of money to that person. So yes, good. And I hope that what happened here is that whoever the lawyer is said that they were going to do this either pro bono or that they would.
Yeah, you know, or someone she knew stepped in and said, I want to fight this on your behalf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, just pay the money, Checkers. Like, don't you have some kind of insurance thing? Like, because she can prove that, like, she didn't withdraw the money and she doesn't know who withdrew the money. The Checkers confirms that, no, it was withdrawn from a location you did not send it to.
Wherever possible, do not go to court. It's just, I can say honestly that unless you have absolute money to burn, I don't think that you should bother going to court. You should try to settle. You should try to get some kind of a deal from whoever you're fighting with. You know, people go to court for all kinds of reasons. Divorces. Really, like, crazy stuff. Just got to be careful what you actually pursue in the courts, because while they're designed to make things fair, they actually just kind of help the rich people. They're not really there for the poor. Joking atheist also says legal aid, take these cases all the time. Of course, you know, there are you know, don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer. There are these legal aid people who do a tremendous job. I mean, we used to, I think we used to do a series with them on some of the cases that they've done over time for people who can't afford legal representation. And it's great that we have these organizations, but they're not going to get everyone right either. And the last thing you want, remember, your cost of losing is just outrageous. Like, if this poor woman had lost, then she would have not only lost the 4,000 Rand, but she would have had to pay huge legal fees. I'm saying if she just went to a lawyer like an ordinary member of the public, if she didn't have someone looking after her, it would have cost her an absolute fortune. So you've got to know when you do this stuff. It's a useful life hack is just try and stay out of court.
I have a funny court story. My best friend is a prosecutor in the Eastern Cape, right? So he travels from town to town, like all the way from our north to Kraaifontein. I had this case where this guy said he'd defend himself. He doesn't want a legal aid attorney. And this legal aid guy apparently is really good. And a guy defends himself, I think, 30 minutes into the trial? He's like, I think I need a lawyer. He goes up to the magistrate, like, I think I need a lawyer. The magistrate is like, you can't. It's already started, my guy. He's like, yeah.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, yo, guys.
Oh, shame, man. That's horrible. Because then, you know, if you try that and it's too late.
It's too late.
You've got no chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't realize when you're in a horrible situation that it's not about telling your story and getting your story right and having someone believe you. It's not about that at all. No. It's about the law and the clauses and the 1.1.1.293s. And if you can tell your story as many times as you like. You need that knowledge behind you.
Exactly. Like now, because you watch Law and Order, you can go.
Yeah, please don't base your your understanding of the courts from like watching TV series. That's a terrible idea as well. All right. And then this is while we're talking about law. I mean, Luthuli House are going to call themselves Ezulwini Investments Head Office.
Yeah, so
they're not allowed to call themselves Luthuli House anymore. No. What the hell is this?
No. This is like an ad agency, right?
This is not rebranding.
No, this is not rebranding. This is not a new logo by any means. So what had happened?
What is it?
You remember when the ANC couldn't pay their people? So apparently they're in massive debt to these people, right?
Yes.
So now they put up their headquarters as collateral. And they can't seem to, like, they lost the case to, like, appeal this, like, Ezulwini from taking their headquarters. So anytime, Ezulwini might come and attach those headquarters. Corner office there.
Imagine if they kick like the ANC out of Luthuli House. Be so
Chief Albert Luthuli would be rolling at his grave. You guys can't even pay where you guys stay.
The humiliation. That is just absolutely unbelievable.
And you expect these people to run. They can't even keep their books in order and you expect them to run a country. Come on, guys.
How embarrassing. We are W's. I thought about this. We've probably discussed this a couple of times on the show, but apparently there's this dude in Belgium who turned up at his own funeral in a helicopter as part of an elaborate prank. You know, I was talking to somebody over the weekend and I said, wouldn't it be funny if this person that I knew who died a little while ago, if he was able to hover over his funeral or his memorial service and see who was there, because I'm pretty sure that some of the people who pitched up at his memorial service, he didn't want there and he didn't have a particularly good relationship with. And you often wonder, because, you know, people always say nice things when you're gone, or at least for the couple of days after you've gone, the first few days, then they become themselves again. But wouldn't it be funny?
You watch them starting to fight over your will, and then you see.
Yeah, you can't invite people to your funeral. They just pitch if they want to pay their respects. But maybe they're people you really hated during life.
Yeah.
So it would be fun to actually pretend you're dead, see who comes to your funeral, see who really cares about you, and also see who you don't want there and say, hey, what the hell are you doing here? I don't even like you. Get out of here. Wouldn't that be fun? It's such a great prank. So this is what this guy did, right?
Yeah, and this guy in Belgium, he faked his own death, waited until the funeral. The whole family was there. They were standing outside at the burial plot, wearing black, crying, you know, giving speeches. And then all of a sudden, this big, smart black helicopter starts hovering over the area. So they all stop talking and they start gathering around and they see this helicopter landing and out pops this guy who's supposed to be dead. I don't know if I agree with this. His entire role goal in all of this was just to make everyone realize how important communication and relationships are. He decided to give his family a wake-up call to show them the importance of staying in touch, because apparently no one had been in touch with him for a while. And he thought to himself, you know, what happens if this is the way I go and we've never spoken again? And so he taught them a lesson. I don't know, isn't it? But it's a bit extreme, don't you think?
I think it's very, it's very cruel to put people through the emotional trauma thinking that you've died. And if they really care about you, you have to be a son of a bitch. Like, you have to have just the hide of a rhino to do this to people who love you and care for you and mess them around. Imagine the emotional trauma of those people, first of all, thinking that someone that they care about has died, and then seeing that person climb out of a helicopter and they're still alive. The resets you have to do. I mean, Dr. Hanan should have stayed on for this one, because you have to be cruel. Like, I think there's an element of absolute sadism to someone who
completely
would do this.
It's so self-centered. It's all about, you're going to miss me when I'm gone. It's all about him.
Yeah.
You're going to miss me when I'm gone.
And instead of just being a normal person and communicating with them and getting together with these family members and saying, you know, imagine I did have to die or you had to die. I'm not happy with the way this would end. Please, can we make a plan to change this? Instead of doing that, he goes and does this whole elaborate prank. I mean, his daughter had written a tribute to her father. Rest in peace, Daddy. I will never stop thinking about you. Why is life so unfair? Why you were going to be a grandfather and you had your whole life. I mean, come on. For this man to just stand, it's all about him. It's horrible.
Pretty horrible.
You don't do that.
They did an episode on Curb on this, right? Where Albert wanted to hear all the good things they're going to say about him, but everyone was in on the gag. So, like, he was upstairs, the funeral was happening downstairs. Larry was supposed to give a speech. So, like, everyone was in, but like this, like, surprise, I'm not dead. That's weird, man. Yeah, but do you remember when the guy came back from the dead in South Africa? This guy.
Which one was that?
Oh, he actually sat up in his coffin.
Yes, this guy who ate a meal at his own funeral.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I think it would be funny to some of us for at least a little bit of the time, but my God, there's got to be something really, really sick in your head for you to do this.
He says only half of his family attended his funeral. And he says other relatives have contacted him since then. And out of it, he says, that proves who really cares about me. Those who didn't come did contact me to meet up. So in a way, I did win. I think you're a loser, buddy.
One of the comments are, and I think this is exactly right, is if you do this, maybe your family will never talk to you again. Yeah. You know, Allison says, I think his family would be angry with him after that and might not speak to him again.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
He's essentially dead to us.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. How can you do that to people? Bet you won't go to the real funeral. Yeah, because now when he does die, they're going to be like, oh, please, he's pulling this shit again.
Yeah.
Right. Only people with more money than sense and too much free time would do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, This is true. I was thinking about someone I know the other day who has too much money, because we often talk about having too little money, right? No, I mean, because we all feel like we would be happier if we had more cash. I know that this is true for you and me and Bakabantu Nian.
Yes.
Right? We think, life would be better if we had more money.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that's probably true. I mean, invariably, it helps most people. It would help you to pay your debts. It would help you to not have to owe more than you have. You'd be able to get some of the things that you need to make life a little bit more bearable, et cetera, et cetera. But the other side of this is having too much money. And I don't know whether we look at this enough, because obviously there are more of us with too little money than there are people with too much. If you have too much money and you think about some of the stupid decisions and the stupid things you can do when you have too much money that is not possible for a poor person to do. Like, this is why you hear about so many rich people whose kids and grandkids end up on drugs, right? Because they have the money.
And they're bored. They're not being challenged in their lives.
Yeah, you want to get into hardcore, like, drug use, and you do it recreationally. And you can afford it. That's different to people who can't afford it.
Yeah.
And going on too many holidays, I mean, it sounds like a dream, right? But if you have so much money that you're constantly going on holidays and you're just spending, 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 and you think about the amount of like disconnect from real life that that gives you. Because then what you're doing is you're kind of messing with the balance in your head. Because your head has to say to you that work is not pain, it's not torment, it's not torture. You shouldn't hate work. Work should be the main purpose for you. It should be something that gives you joy and satisfaction. It's your place to contribute to society. And if you're constantly on holiday, I don't know that that's entirely right, that you're giving your brain false signals about things. Also, imagine how like self-centered you're going to become if you have just money to burn and you're literally living just to do things like this guy with the helicopter at the funeral. You're messing with other people because he couldn't do this if he was poor. He couldn't hire a helicopter and do this if he had no money, right?
Yeah.
I hope he compensated the family for the funeral costs as well and their travel expenses. No. And
bastard.
Yeah.
Are you saying these are rich people problems, Gareth?
I don't like him. That's all yeah. I ask. I don't like this guy. Yeah, I think these are rich people problems. I think when you have too much money, you have too much money when you stop worrying about it, says Joking Atheist. No, but you see, the other thing is that when you're really, really rich, people are always after your money. So you don't know who you can really trust. You don't know who your real friends are. You don't know what people's motives are because you always have to guess that somewhere along the way, they're after your cash. They just want something from you.
More money, more problems.
I'm telling you, there's a reason that exists as a thought, like in the culture. It's a proper thing. Okay, so apparently increasing numbers of new graduates in China are turning to risky food delivery work as youth unemployment soars. Now, we know we have this problem in South Africa. In fact, I have a picture here. I took this. You can't really see it, so I'm just going to hold it up to the camera so you can see what I saw. And then I'll explain what's going on, because I was driving behind this duo of delivery guys yesterday on their bikes. You know, they call them? 60-60 and pick and pay, ASAP or whatever. So here are these two guys, right? They're on their bikes. You see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of next to each other, having a chat.
They're next to each other at the robot. And the one guy's got his box on the back of his bike. And it says there on a piece of paper that he's stuck on with sticky tape, it says gone too soon with a picture and Trymore is the guy's name. Rest in peace, Trymore. And I thought, first of all, how sad that, you know, and we know these guys are risky drivers and they get involved in more accidents than taxis even. But there's a community there because if this guy's driving around with this sign on, and I saw another guy later in the day with the same piece of paper on his bike, and I don't think it was the same guy. I thought, wow, you know, that tells you something about communities, because we use that word way too much. And obviously, all these delivery guys spend a lot of time waiting outside of restaurants with each other. They get to know each other. They parked in the same area waiting for business to come in. And it's a hard job. It's a really tough job. Yeah. We spoke about tipping before. How important that is. But obviously this Trymore dude was killed in the line of duty, so to speak, you know, doing his job. And the other guys are all wearing this thing proudly on their bikes, like rest in peace. I think that's spectacular, because mostly in society, people just go, oh, well, too bad, move on. I'm like, good. Yeah. These guys are doing this. It made me more aware. It's like, okay, there's, you know, these are people with families and jobs and friends, and you just suddenly think, shit, they're not just a convenience. They're actually pretty hardworking people. They're certainly doing more than everybody who's just sitting waiting for their SASSA grant to come in. And I admire that. And I also think it's really touching that they are memorializing one of the other guys in the best way they can by showing all of us in traffic that they care about each other. I think that's quite special.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in this case in China, what's happened now is that there is this kind of move for people in China who are battling to find jobs, newly graduated. So they're qualified in something, can't find jobs. And so they become these food delivery workers. And apparently what's happened is that there's this rumor that a restaurant on a tiny island province just off the southernmost tip of China sells beef offal soup priced at the equivalent of $200. And they send out prostitutes, right?
Sure.
Dressed as these food delivery riders. And police have denied the rumor. This all kind of came to a head in early November. But what's happened now is that quite a few influencers have jumped on this kind of trend of dressing up in inverted commas provocatively, so with short skirts, black stockings, and high heels, with the, like in this case, what's the delivery company called here? Meituan. They're wearing the Meituan t-shirt and delivering food. So now what's happened is, speaking of communities, that the community of Meituan has come together and said, we don't want this happening. It's offensive to female delivery workers. And these influencers are literally doing it to get pull and clout. So they attacked one in particular.
I don't understand any of this. You're going to have to start again.
Yeah, like me too. I'm like,
Are we talking about delivery people or prostitutes, or are they the same in China?
I'm not okay.
Or influencers.
We're talking about influencers. Okay, so an influencer has put up this picture that I've given you, and the community of delivery workers has lashed out and said, "We want you to apologize," because basically she is stigmatizing female food delivery workers around the country. I don't know what
she's calling them prozzies.
Yes, basically.
But are they prozzies?
The person in the picture is not. She's an influencer and she's showing a trend. But there are rumors of this happening in China.
Okay, so I'm just trying to see what this could do for us. So do you want your delivery people to dress more provocatively? I mean, would that make a difference when you order your Uber Eats?
Can they just arrive on time?
No.
That's all I want.
I think what the story says to me is that it's really sad that a lot of graduates who are professional and have, you know, worked hard to get their degrees cannot find jobs. So they're resorting to becoming Mr. D or Uber delivery people. And they're offering an extra service on top of that when they get to deliver your food. So they're dressing provocatively, ringing on your doorbell and saying, can I give you a little extra service here?
Right. Okay. So it's basically a way to up the ante and get some more business out of the people you're delivering to. It's like those really bad pornos where people go, I've brought your food. But they're wearing nothing and their titties are hanging out.
Yeah, okay, like, I don't have money to pay. You can pay me in other ways.
I've come to the same
exactly. Wow. All right. So, that's exciting, right?
And it makes me wonder if it's happening here.
Oh, no, it's definitely happening here. I've heard stories. Not with Uber Eats.
Really?
No, not with Uber Eats, right? So Uber drivers, like talkers, right? So this one guy is like, yo, bruh, I once like got requested. This chick asked me if how much do I earn a night. I'm like, around about 2,000. She's like, yeah, here's 2,000. Let's just talk and let's see where that leads. I'm like, yo. The guy is like, I'm uncomfortable with this. This other chick refused to leave the car. Started kissing him. He's driving, and the chick no.
Oh wow.
So it does happen.
Okay, so I must be the most naive person in the world, because the last thing I'm thinking about when I order Uber Eats or Mr. Delivery is thinking about prostitution. Yeah. It's like, it's not even in my universe of thoughts. When I'm ordering food, I'm like, I'm hungry. I don't give a shit who delivers it. Someone could deliver it and she could be the most beautiful woman in the world. He could be the best looking guy in the world. I won't notice, because as soon as I have that food in my hands, I'm like, thank you. Bye. Cheers. Thank you. Very good.
Also, the reason you've ordered food is because you're probably in your tracksuit pants at home. You haven't made your bed and the dishes are piling up. Exactly. And you haven't shaved. You probably haven't showered. And that's the reason you've ordered. You're not going to be in the mood to do other stuff.
Are you joking? This weekend, it was so hot. I think I ordered something on yeah, Friday evening. So, and I went out without a shirt on. That's how little of a shit I gave. I was like, I don't care. So I would not be thinking about prostitutes at that moment. Sorry.
No, yeah. Definitely not.
All right. Very good. Very good. So just by the way, Leanne, we have to, and I have to agree with Carl, that story was incoherent. Is Leanne drunk again? It took you a long time to get to the point. Really, Buckabuntu, Carl, and I were all very confused by you. I don't know what you were on. Jesus. Yeah. You told that story like a drunk aunt.
Green tea. Like
someone at a braai. Can you imagine like some drunk aunt or uncle at a braai trying to tell you something when they never get to the point? Yeah. That was how it was with you.
No, we all have that rakhadi. Yo, we all have that one.
I blame it on the heat.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right, listen, I want to introduce you to someone called Tamin Dlovu, who is the founder and CEO of Data Advise, which is making waves in the market research and consulting industry. Now, he's from Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. He's achieved a remarkable feat. He's got into the top 1% of market research and competitive intelligence experts in the world. So I immediately saw that and thought, got to talk to this guy. And he's currently based in the U.S., but I want to hear about how he started this company. Like he's moved through some amazing management consulting firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers, Investor Group Services. He's worked with some of the smartest people in business. And he can provide all sorts of market research insights that I think we'll all find very, very interesting. Let me welcome him to the show this morning because I think we'll enjoy talking to this guy. Hey, Tommy, how are you?
Hi, good morning, Garrett. Thanks for having me and thanks for the introduction.
Sure, man. It's nice to talk to you. So whereabouts in the U.S. are you?
I'm in the South. I'm in Georgia, in Atlanta. So I've moved around quite a bit, though. I moved to Boston around 2017. And that was sort of like the landing pad for me. And I want to say it was Boston first, and then I moved to Dallas, and then now I'm in Atlanta in Georgia.
Well, listen, first of all, congratulations on being in the top 1% of market research people in the world. I mean, you've got to have some insights, which you're going to share these with us for free, whether you like it or not this morning. We want to hear. But that's quite an accolade, and it's a very competitive industry. So what you're talking about here and what you do for a living is something that is very much in demand across the world. People are desperate to know what consumers want. You know, we just had Black Friday, and we were talking about how in South Africa, it was largely a flop. I mean, it didn't turn out to be, and I don't know what the stats are for America at this point, but it wasn't this huge, you know, teeming mob of people waiting outside stores to get, you know, 50, 60% off. It was a handful of people who got like 10 to 15% off because the margins are so tight in this country. But doing things like that is what market research is, right?
Yeah. Essentially, that's what it is. And it's booming right now. You're right about that. People have gone as far as calling it the new oil. Data is very important for businesses to make decisions. And we're seeing sort of a wave in data and data-driven decision-making. And so, you know, I think it's new depending on what region that you work in, right? So I've worked with clients in the Middle East. I've worked with clients in the U.S., basically every other geography, Europe, etc. And I realized that the appetite for information is different depending on how competitive each environment is, right? So the U.S. is very cutthroat, and so you see a lot of innovation going on, but that's a result of people making information based on the decisions that there's based on the data that's out there, you know? So that's some of the trends that I'm seeing. As far as sort of the Middle East, I think it's overtaking sort of Silicon Valley in that sense because they are also hungry for new information as well. And Europe is sort of the third party in that race.
Mm-hmm. How's South Africa doing? I mean, where do we fit into this?
Yeah, so South Africa in Africa is sort of like a green market, I think, in this space, right? I think there's a lot of information that could be structured and utilized for generating insights for businesses to act upon. And there are very few companies that are taking advantage of this. I think not only is this data-driven decision-making approach a new thing, but there are also even fewer players who are participating and giving businesses real insights. And so I think with Africa, it's sort of a green market. South Africa, I've seen a lot of good research firms. I used to study at Vets myself, and then I moved to the US later on. But I started realizing that there were a lot of research firms as well that compete on the continent. A few leading players, but more generally, the space is fragmented. There's a lot of competition there. Not enough people are using data within the marketplace to make decisions. So I think it's a green market.
All right. So Tommy, I'm going to cut right to the chase on this one because it's something that drives me up the wall. And I am so tired of like a bunch of number crunches taking all the creativity and excitement out of business and out of marketing and turning it all into a big data dive where everybody is so busy looking at the interpretation of this statistic or extrapolating this into meaning that or defining some kind of marketing strategy going forward based on these numbers. Don't you feel that a lot of this information is almost too much for people and that as a result of this information, they find themselves captured? They find themselves like unable to think creatively because unless the numbers tell them something, they actually can't make a decision. And most of the time, it's all down to interpretation anyway. So they're sitting there with their hands behind their back waiting for some number to save them.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting way of framing the story, right? Because I think the data has to tell a story. There has to be some kind of it's like when you're driving, you need a GPS. Without that information, it's almost impossible to get to your destination, or at least with accurately or in the most efficient way, the shortest route possible, etc. So yeah. I think that yes, we live in the information age. Yes, organizations are overwhelmed with information, but those are organizations that don't have data governance structures that are going to be able to sort of organize that information and generate insights for them that can be actionable, that they can then implement, right? So it becomes a headache if you don't have the foundation of the house. And what you need is sort of that infrastructure to be able to help you to make those decisions. So I don't think that it's necessarily true that marketers and other business leaders are inept in terms of making decisions without the information. I think it's important in an enhancer in the decision-making process instead of using sort of this crystal ball approach or sort of using your gut feeling as people used to do back in the day, you know?
Well, I mean, you can probably have both, but my worry is just that a lot of these businesses are so reliant on the numbers now that they actually do find themselves paralyzed.
I was going to say, Gareth, I think what Gareth is going for, Tommy, is that so you say we need a map, like a map, right? A GPS, but now there's no new ground. You guys aren't creating new roads. You guys are just rotating and collecting the information of what is. There's a bankrupt of creativity and moving forward and forward thinking. It's all about maintaining what we have.
I see. Well, you know, obviously I have a bias towards information. Yeah, as someone who always guides entrepreneurs, business leaders, etc., I always guide them on the numbers. I always guide them on the figures. And I think there is a case to be made there where you can find a sweet spot between making decisions in a nimble, faster way, in a more agile way, compared to just being bogged down in the numbers and sort of having that paralysis analysis. So I would say that as soon as you figure out that you have enough information, at least to get you out of the woods in terms of making assumptions that are baseless, then you can sort of be creative in terms of the solutions that you come up with. Well, the data tells us this. I've advised firms, for example, who when we do some due diligence work for them, when they want to acquire another business, they'll say, hey, listen, we understand and respect your decision that you don't think it's a good idea, but we're still going to go in this way, right? So in that sense, they don't always take the recommendation of the consultant, and they still bring in their own sort of feelings and thoughts to the matter and then act on that.
All right. So tell me a little bit about your business. So what do you do to help businesses figure out the way forward? Because that is so valuable. I think everybody understands that if you don't have the ability to kind of predict the path that a business might be on and what that might result in, you're not really helping them. So what does Data Advise do?
All right. I think one of the ways that we help companies is in helping them sort of make that first actionable, take that first actionable step. Instead of just providing them insights, what we do is we also consult on providing them solutions and steps to realize those insights that you've generated for them. I think that's a big differentiator, because people, like you're saying, they don't just want to see numbers and then be bogged down in the analysis of those numbers. What you want to do is be able to give them actionable recommendations and say, hey, listen, based on the information, this is what we're finding. But to dovetail it to your organization, this is exactly what you need to do. So that's one of the ways that we'll come into the market and sort of make a difference compared to other players in the space. Another way that I, you know, in terms of your other question, how do we help businesses? Say, for example, you had a growth opportunity in New York somewhere or up north, and you try to move into that space, but you don't know anything about the consumers in the north. You don't know which businesses are operating in the specific zip codes that you want to target. You have no information about this, right? So you need a way to sort of illuminate the path forward. And the way to do that is through the information. So we'll go in the space and understand basically what are the competitors, how are they positioned, how are they winning, what's their unique selling propositions, what are the technology trends in the space, right? Is there some kind of disruptor on the horizon that could potentially come in and jeopardize market leadership if they were to become market leaders in the space? What about legal regulations? Are there any regulations that could potentially impact the growth trajectory of the firm? So those are sort of like the things we would look at, that 5,000 foot snapshot that helps them to gain a better understanding of what is going on in the marketplace. And that's where we come in.
All right, very good. Let's just talk a little bit about the adversities that a lot of entrepreneurs have, because I think for many people, especially in South Africa, starting a small business is damn difficult. Finding your gap in the market is really hard. Being competitive in that market is really difficult. With all of the information that you manage to gather as someone who's a market research expert, like what can you tell us about the way that the market's moving at the moment and what the biggest challenges are that businesses face in this current environment?
Yeah, we're living in a tough economic environment right now. So it's hyperinflationary pressures. We've got wars all over the place. You know, inflation is going up, which is causing, you know, a lot of people to sort of tighten their purses. Companies are cutting budgets. They aren't even hiring outside help. Consultants are having a tough time getting opportunities because obviously if the shoestrings or purse strings are being tightened, what happens is that they ask you to sharpen the pencil a bit more as a consultant as well. So what I'm seeing is a lot of lack of innovation is happening. Companies aren't IPOing as they used to. Capital isn't flowing to specific industries that we saw, especially in technology, that we saw a boom of between 2020 and 2022, right? So we saw a lot of capital flowing to especially B2B SaaS businesses. Now, that hasn't been happening right now. And it's all a result of what's going on within the macroeconomic environment. So that's one of the things that we're seeing. And companies are now adapting, right? So I know for a fact that we've started utilizing AI a lot to improve our efficiencies. We've started using that to basically find room within our budgets as well and bring some of that stuff that we were outsourcing in-house, which is been a good thing as well, because we've innovated in a sense, right? And we've figured out how to do it ourselves as opposed to going outside and looking for help. So those are some of the trends that I'm seeing in the space that are interesting. It's not all doom and gloom. There are other industries where I'm seeing bigger investments flowing to. For example, all these AI companies, they're seeing a lot of investments. A lot of investors are betting on them. So There's a bit of opportunity, but it's all in pockets.
Yeah, and Africa as a marketplace is still interesting to people. I mean, you mentioned it's a green market, which I think is exciting. But Africa is obviously a huge market of consumers, young people who are hungry for product. They want to get involved in brands. They want to hustle, sell, buy. Is Africa still an exciting place? I mean, even from the point of view of you being in America, is it still an exciting place to be prospecting?
It is. I think what's interesting about Africa is that it's on the precipice of sort of this new wave of innovation and entrepreneurship, which I think is going to happen within the next 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. The biggest impediment that I've seen is the lack of access to cash for transacting, that there's still a lot of unbanked individuals within the continent. And with that number, you know, sort of decreasing over the years with M-Pesa, I know in Kenya, with EcoCash, I know in Zimbabwe, I'm not quite sure how people have transacted in other regions. But once that becomes very ubiquitous, that means people are able to access and purchase goods a bit more, that those dollars are going to flow to entrepreneurs who are going to be able to at least scale up our business, in theory, scale up their businesses and then hire more people, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the waves that have happened in the Western world, history repeats itself. We're going to see a bit of those happening on the continent. And AI, I think, is the biggest opportunity that I'm seeing, where there's going to be a lot of wealth generation with new ideas, new business models, new products and services on the marketplace. And so I think taking advantage of sort of those pockets will be interesting and going to allow for foreign direct investment to flow, I think, into certain areas or certain industries that are taking advantage of those new technologies.
We could certainly hope so. All right. So quickly, you're doing a podcast series with Lebo Lion, who I met the other day for the first time. She's a very impressive human being all on her own. And she's doing the series with you called Through a Global Lens. What's that all about?
Yeah. So we've been ideating for quite a while, and we've been going back and forth in terms of figuring out the concept for the show. But basically, what we're trying to do there is alleviate the depth of knowledge that we're seeing in terms of entrepreneurship specifically, but also generally business problems. So through my expertise in having worked in different global markets, I've worked and lived in London. I've been here in Boston, as I was saying, New York, and now here in Atlanta. So you tend to see a lot. And I started to juxtapose what I've seen and the experiences that I've gained versus the average entrepreneur on the continent. And so we're trying to brief some of those learnings, bring in some of the colleagues that I've met along the years, and really provide some insight into how the global standard, what the global standard looks like, and how we can implement some of those learnings on the continent so that we can boost businesses. And I also definitely identify with most of the challenges because I was an entrepreneur on the continent as well. So really bringing that perspective is what I find important, and is going to help us build out opportunities for potential employment. Entrepreneurship, I think, is the way and the conduit for that. So that's what we're trying to bring to the continent.
Well, listen, it's such a pleasure to meet you, and I wish you and Lebo best, all the best with your podcast that you're going to be doing, and I'm sure it's going to be worth listening to. But Tommy, thank you for your time today, and I hope we get to check in with you again soon. Are you visiting home anytime soon?
Thank you, Gareth. I appreciate it. As soon as I find space in the calendar, definitely.
Tommy, job, just man. Before you go, there was something that I read in your bio which resonated with me, and that's the difficulties that you faced during COVID. I myself lost my business during that time, and went from being a homeowner to trying to sell my house. That's only pulled through now, can you believe it, since COVID had just kind of ended. And just facing real difficulties and having to shift your mindset from being someone who provided a service that was so high-end to thinking about how companies can resolve their issues and their money issues and their marketing issues, when all you're trying to do is survive from day to day. And for me, making that shift from survival and living every, you know, day by day, to now getting into my job where I was thinking about the bigger picture, it was a big shift. How did you find that for yourself? How did you go from stopping worrying about how you're going to get through the day to now thinking about a company's big future?
Yeah, I think it's an important question as well, right? Because it ties into the story of the foundations of the business. I started the business in 2020, and Gareth mentioned that I moved through quite a few firms. But in 2020, I actually lost my employment with one of the firms I was working with in Boston, because it was COVID. Everything came to a halt, and I suddenly found myself in a foreign country, and facing sort of the challenge of trying to figure out the next step. And that's when I put my experiences together and I formed the organization. So the legal experience and the business experience and the research experience from one of the firms that I was working at. And so the idea there was, hey, listen, you've got all these qualifications. What can you do with them, right? And how can you figure out a path forward? So that was during COVID. I had to sit down and think about that. And it was a tough time. You know, it's very difficult to build a business, let alone build a business in a foreign country. So that was, I think, one of my main challenges. And with that, I think resilience, perseverance in terms of figuring it out, task management, figuring out how to prioritize your time, figuring out how to box out personal issues from the business. Sometimes very difficult if you're an entrepreneur because you eat what you kill, you know. So it can be very challenging to not price the client based on your needs, right? So there was a bit of compartmentalization there, but you know, throughout those challenges in terms of figuring out the way forward, I used some of those techniques in terms of prioritization, task allocation, basically trying to take the learnings from back home, earlier values that you have been instilled in you, those carry you in environments like this. So that's really how I coped with that, and managed to come out to the other side, you know, bit of battle scars, but most generally unscathed, and we're here.
I'm impressed. I think that's such good advice. Over and above everything else that you've said, is like you've got to have that resilience. And I'm just pleased that there are success stories coming out on this side of things, because as Leanne said, lots of people took a huge knock during that 2020, 2021 time.
Right. Yeah. I think once the clock was stopped and you had to sit with your thoughts and sort of figure out what the next move was, a lot of people also came out with some terrific ideas. So it worked out for the for the good as well for other people, such as myself.
One last thing quickly, Tommy, because I think, you know, when many of us consider market research, we also think about all these people who are researching where they're getting this the raw data from, because we all feel like we are the data, we are the product, and there are so many people mining our data on a day-to-day basis. We've got to guard against this, right? Every country has their rules. In South Africa, we've got something called the Protection of Personal Information Act. I don't know whether it does any good or not, because everybody seems to have our phone numbers, everybody seems to know where we bank, everybody seems to know a whole lot about us that we didn't volunteer. So in market research, there are ethics involved, and there are things that you guys have to follow the rules for, I should hope, because people's information is actually theirs. They don't, they have to consent to giving it up, right?
Yeah, right. I think, you know, we should put the blame squarely on the marketers for that. They ruin everything. You know, there's a saying that marketers ruin everything. But I would say, yeah, in Europe there's GDPR, right? So there are rules and standards for sort of anonymizing certain data. You find this as well in healthcare. There's HIPAA, which protects patient information. So there are generally ethical considerations that you have to instill within the organization, that would help protect people's personal information, right? That said, though, it depends on the degree of privacy that these different protections allow for. Generally, if you see an SMS come in, you're allowed to opt out. That's, I think, the Personal Protection Information Act. I think it's PIA or something that regulates that. So you're allowed to opt out. So there are certain guidelines and certain actions that you can take. It's just generally people don't know. And so they continually receive these marketing messages or these annoying emails and things like that. People generally don't have an understanding of how those limitations work, but there are definitely limitations. For clients, for example, they want to do some of this data searching anonymously, and they don't want to be sort of identified by potential competitors whenever we're doing some of this research work, and to understand that, well, these guys are moving in this direction because they're researching this space, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of you know, ethical considerations that are there in the background when you're doing research work.
Well, you hope so. But I think it's an important thing to reflect on, because most of us are just so damn sick of hearing from people we don't know who are trying to do market research on us when we haven't.
It's not stopping anytime soon.
I know.
It's going worse.
It's so frustrating. All right, but thank you so much. It's great to hear from you. And Tommy, best of luck with your podcast series and all your businesses going forward. You can follow Tommy on the social medias. Here's his stuff quickly. Tommy Global. Is that on Instagram and X?
Yeah, that's on Instagram and X.
Brilliant. That's at Tommy Global on both. All right, dude. Thank you so much. Nice to see you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Looking forward to the podcast in January.
Lovely. Very good. That'll be with Lebo Lion, and that's all coming up in January next year. Lovely stuff. All right, Leanne Moll and Bakabantu Gata. What are we going to do with the rest of our week? Are we going to be productive?
Lots of work to do. And it's the December rush. So, yeah, clients want stuff now for January.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah.
Try and get that stuff done so that you can at least have a week's rest.
Also, there's
just
like
letting your mind relax.
AN function time. So like, yeah.
Oh, urine functions. Yeah.
Yeah. I know it. Urine functions.
I managed to sidestep a few of these, but there are one or two coming up that I'm going to go to. And I will, I'll definitely report back, because those are usually the things where the seriously fun stuff happens, yeah. You know, the embarrassing stuff.
The ones where you've got to check your WhatsApps the next day to see what you sent.
Yep. Don't do that. Don't fall into those traps. Keep work and pleasure separate. Yeah. All right, everybody. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Have an awesome Monday. Cheers. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.